Hello, and welcome to the My Beautifully Rare podcast. I am your co-host, Bryn Bish, and with me I have my partner in crime and my better half, Sam Bish. Today we will be discussing part two of Killian's story, where we will be discussing his path of recovery through four open heart surgeries, a major cardiac arrest, life support, and brain injury rehab. Today's episode is sponsored by Goat Soaps Arizona, the only skin product you will need for this winter. Each soap is handcrafted by the goats that she raises on her farm, and it's 100% American-made. Her soap is the only soap that Killian uses to battle things like eczema and dry skin, especially in the winter. Use the code KILLIAN20 to get 20% off your order. And to visit her shop, visit the link below in the show notes. So, Sam, we did kind of a mean thing to our listeners, which was we...
Cliffhanger.
It was a big cliffhanger.
Yeah.
And then we all got sick for like 2 to 3. I don't know what it is about this winter.
Oh, it's been bad.
There has been so much illness going around. We got the flu, and then just different houses got, you know, sickness, and then we were into the holidays. And
mm-hmm.
So our grand plans of having part one and two be a week apart
quickly that did not happen.
Fell apart. Yeah. So we are sorry.
But we're here now. We're here. We're ready to go.
I hope everybody had a happy, healthy holiday. So where we left off was that Killian, we went through the process of how a hospital will deliver typically a child with a complex heart defect.
That has been diagnosed prenatally beforehand.
Diagnosed prenatally. And so that's kind of where we left off. And then we were going to talk about leading into the first major heart surgery. So walk us through what that experience was like.
Mm. So like starting the night before, right? Like you kind of want to back it up, like going into it.
Mm-hmm.
Night before, we both stayed at the hospital. I remember they usually only let one parent stay at a time. I think that was maybe COVID rules that they just kind of adopted or mm-hmm. whatever. But usually only one parent stays. Our case was a little bit different. They let both of us stay. Mm-hmm. Which was a room we got very, very familiar with as time went on. However, the idea, you know, small bed, one, you know, twin size for one person ideally, but there's two people there. So I know the emotional attachment that you had, especially with Killian.
Yes.
Obviously carrying him, going through the birthing process, actually getting to see him, seeing how much he was struggling to breathe,
mm-hmm.
just... the discoloration, everything. I know you were very attached, so I'm pretty sure you sat and held him all night.
Oh my gosh,
you didn't even sleep.
I actually want to talk about, because this is something I talked about a little bit in our podcast last time, but this was postpartum complex CHD,
mm-hmm.
and this is where I feel like there is a significant gap of resources with complex CHD surgeries. So there I was, postpartum room, and I was there for about a day. The cardiologist, I think we talked about this the last time, but they came in and they said, you know, Killian's not breathing super well, so we want to rush the surgery.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was discharged, and after delivering, mm-hmm. and probably TMI, but I had a pretty bad injury. And so I didn't go home. I didn't recover in my bed. Mm-hmm. I didn't, you know, have my normal postpartum experience.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the baby blues that were hitting, that hormone crash, it actually hit the night before his major operation.
Mm-hmm.
So you're right. There I was, like, so in so much pain, so uncomfortable,
yeah.
sitting in this, like, uncomfortable wooden chair, basically,
yeah.
And holding Killian. And it was so hard to watch him breathe.
Wooden chair, like we're in the 1890s.
I mean,
it had cushions on it. But to be fair, they were very rigid.
They
were. I get where you're coming from.
Yeah. And
yeah.
And then it wasn't any better, like, in the back, because it was, like, you know, a cot-sized sofa that you were sleeping on.
Yeah.
So
I can fall asleep anywhere, though.
It's not a big deal for me. It's Marine training right there. So anyways, I just wanted to, you know, if there are any moms who are wondering what could help with that postpartum experience, post a comment let me know, because I do have thoughts about what I would do differently mm-hmm. for my postpartum, because I did not prep for that at all.
Yeah.
And it was my first child. I had no idea what to expect.
Now, obviously, if you're listening to this in a podcast service, most don't have the ability to post comments except for YouTube. So obviously, feel free to drop a YouTube comment. We check that occasionally. If not, our Instagram, which, do you know the handle off the top of your head? I know it's a relatively new account.
We do this all the time. We always forget it.
Yeah.
It's like at the beautifully rare life.
It's like the_beautifully_. We'll put it in the show comments.
Yeah, we'll put the link
reference
there.
But any questions mm-hmm. regarding that, obviously Bryn would love to answer them. So
anyways, sorry. I wanted to talk about that because it was super important.
No, that's important.
Hit us with the first surgery.
Oh, goodness. Okay, yeah. So night of, it was a long couple of days, you know, for me. I was especially exhausted. You know,
I don't want to hear it. I don't want to hear it.
I needed my rest.
No, really, you did. You did a phenomenal job.
I did. Okay. Yeah, I did a pretty good job.
They were straight about to hire Sam because he had such a calming voice.
The breathing patterns.
Breathing patterns.
Yeah. So I was exhausted. I obviously spent my time with Killian before, you know, the nighttime and all that, but I passed out. Bryn stayed up, as we already talked about. Morning of, first case, ready to go, first thing bright and early. And because Killian was having the breathing issues and they were saying, you know, this is, you know, we need to expedite this, the surgery took place on a Saturday, which is not normal. They so he was born February 15th is his birthday. And then President's Day, it's the first Monday after, you know, right? Or does it have a specific date? That is terrible. I can't remember.
No, I think it's the first Monday. That's what I thought.
Yeah. So anyway, that coming Monday, which is when they were going to schedule the surgery for the next week, since I think he was born on like a Thursday or something like that, right? Maybe a Wednesday. Anyway, the surgery was supposed to take place the next week. It was obviously expedited. President's Day, it wouldn't have happened until Tuesday. So they said, no, we have to do this on Saturday, which in a way kind of worked out in our favor because the surgical waiting room, completely empty.
Oh my gosh.
Nobody in there. I mean, it kind of gave us the opportunity to kind of like set up shop for the day because the mm-hmm. surgery took 10 hours, 11 mm-hmm. hours.
Yeah.
Maybe pushing 12. I can't remember.
Yeah.
Started super early. First case, I think 6 a.m. They took him back.
Yeah.
Like it was, you know, crack of dawn. He was getting taken back there. So
what my mom and I did was we actually broke down a prayer vigil every hour. So every hour we prayed for a different person in the operating room, anesthesiologists, nurses, mm-hmm. obviously the heart surgeon, you know, and we just, it was a way. And what my mom did is she would send out a blast. First of all, we did it in advance. We said, anybody who wants to have this prayer vigil and like help, you know, we'll let you know when he goes in for surgery. And then at the top of the hour, pray for, you know, a different person on the care team. So that's what we did. And my mom, you know, kind of pushed out these alerts. We had probably thousands of people praying for him. I had mm-hmm. my cousin is a monk. He is in a monastery at Oklahoma. I think he was doing the prayer vigil.
Yeah.
And his whole monastery was doing the prayer vigil. I mean, it was wild. We had people from all parts. We had people in Brazil, the UK,
mm-hmm.
Australia, New Zealand, like so many people praying for him. It was kind of crazy, but it really helped us kind of get through that really long, hot, like, you know, what do I think? How do I occupy my mind? And it was really great. So at the top of the hour, your family and our family mm-hmm. would gather together, and we would all pray for that respective party. It was kind of cool.
It was really nice too because your parents were there, my parents were there. It was nice that, you know, both sides of the grandparents were directly involved.
Yeah.
Everybody was there in person. The prayer vigil, I think we kind of like took turns on who was going to lead it for that hour. So, you know, the first hour was one person, second hour, you know, so on and so forth. So it was really nice and convenient to have, obviously, the family that, you know, we're most close with, I guess, you know, from our each, you know, perspective side being actually there, you mm-hmm. know, putting their hands on you and, you know, actually praying with you. That was,
But then we fell asleep.
We did. I'm sure we
have a picture.
I know that picture is somewhere floating around in some social media page or something like that. It got posted at some point, didn't it?
Yeah, it did.
Yeah.
So we wake up and there's like our Killian's heart surgeon.
By the end, that's when I was kind of starting to get really tired. Because we were up super early, obviously. Yeah, so towards the end, I'm like getting tired. So that's when I laid down when the picture was taken. We were woken up by somebody's parents to the heart surgeon, like Bryn just said, standing directly in front of us, like looking down on us pretty much.
Now, here's a man who was like just operating on probably one of the most complex surgeries, heart surgeries that could ever be performed. And then he looks at us and he smiles and he goes, "Are you guys a little sleepy?" You know, it's just so funny. His heart surgeon is such a humble,
yes,
you know, God-fearing man. And he's also hilarious and brilliant. And so we're very just blessed
Not
to have
even
him.
Mention that the night before we were celebrating my birthday.
Yeah. Because
for those that don't know, for those that don't know, Killian's birthday is a day before mine. So Killian's is February 15th. I'm February 16th. So the night before his surgery, before, you know, we go up to the room and settle in for the night, we had a birthday celebration dinner in the hospital cafeteria.
My favorite birthday celebration we've ever had for you.
That was actually pretty fun. Yeah.
So memorable.
So we're gathered around this table, you know, Bryn's parents, my brother was there. And the heart surgeon comes up and sits at the table with us and talks to us for a good 5 or 10 minutes. Like, it wasn't just a, "Hey, you know, I was told you guys are here. Here's what to expect tomorrow. All right, see you in the morning." It was like a sit down, ask who everybody was, you know,
kind of
get to know
us
a little bit, learn some names, you know, spoke a little bit on just the experience, you know, his experience, what to expect. It was just a very personable interaction. And
he actually walked us through exactly what he was going to do with the in the operation, which when he does that, it's so cool because he has this like 1,000-mile gaze, and you could see he's literally mapping it out in his mind.
Yeah.
Like, he is going through his own step-by-step process. Like, he doesn't look at you. He has like a solid gaze out in the distance of, you know, who knows where. But yeah, it was cool. He didn't just stand by the table. Like, he literally like made my parents, it was like a little round booth. He made my parents move to the side so he could squeeze in to the booth.
No, but I love that.
And I love that. Yeah, it was amazing. Yeah, so Boston is just incredible. Yeah. Like, the people they...
So that's backfilling, obviously. So, you know, that happened the night before. Mm-hmm. We're you know, in the waiting room. He comes in, you know, standing over us, wakes us up, and, you know, goes through how the surgery went. And this is where I think time stood still for me, because this is when, you know, we always talk about you're the anticipation, the moments leading up. I don't worry about it until it's right in front of me. That's when it was right in front of me, right? This is when we were going to find out how it went, what happens, what the future looks like,
what he looks like.
Yes. And obviously we had our check-ins
from the nurse that was kind of coordinating.
Betsy.
Yeah.
She's amazing. She probably's not going to listen to this,
yeah,
so we can say her name. Amazing. Best, one of the best nurses we've ever had.
Every time we had an admission, I'm pretty sure every single time we saw her and got the chance to talk to her for at least a little bit.
Yeah. She's amazing.
So anyway,
that's when time kind of stood still for me. Like, I remember the conversation. I remember him talking to us. I remember him walking through it. But, you know, like, when you're in the moment of something and it's just like you're just staring, like, really the only thing I remember from that was he's okay. You know, I don't know if you have a different experience.
No, I the one phrase I remember was it went as well as we were hoping for, and there were no complications. Now, the no complications part for a stage one operation is, I mean, these hearts that they're operating on are like the size of a little bit smaller than an acorn, and they're doing very technical operations. And so there is, like, this is why we moved to Boston, because the success rate, depending on the institution, can be as low as 35 or as high as in the 80s. And it all has to do with the skill of the surgeon, the equipment that they have to help operate. And so when he said that, for like, I just had this huge sigh of relief, because that's not typically the case. Like, these are very, very, this is, they call it the Norwood operation, and it's one of the trickiest heart operations that can be performed. And so the risk of complication is like, it's almost like just expect it to happen.
Yeah. And from what we read and from what we were told, the Norwood operation was originally developed and created at Boston Children's.
Yeah.
So it was really cool. We were kind of like you know, Killian's procedure was done where, you know, these, you know,
yeah,
stage surgeries were developed. Mm-hmm.
So we go to see him.
Yeah. So we go to see him. Obviously sedated, intubated. Gosh, it was so long ago now. I'm trying to remember exact feelings.
It's, you know, I think that we had really prepped ourselves,
yeah,
to, you know, expect the worst. And, you know, you look at the, I think the hardest part, at least for me, was the leading up to, I wonder what this is going to, how he's going to look, what it's, mm-hmm, you know, and this is like a postpartum thing, like a woman thing, but, you know, a lot of women have like OCD thoughts after, because you have the hormone crash, and so you have a lot of these, like, you know, mental health shifts, and so you have this like vulnerable baby, but like times 100, because he's got tubes coming out of him, he's got an open chest,
yeah,
you know, and he's so swollen because you do, you know, anything to the body, and your heart, your body just retains fluid as a method of protection, mm-hmm, and so he,
yeah, all the chest tubes, the
he
draining,
was a 6-pound yeah, baby, and then he literally looked like a toddler the next time we saw him because he was so swollen.
Yeah.
I remember looking that, at, and without knowing that before, you know, Betsy kind of walked us through everything, I was like, I don't remember me birthing a child that large.
Oh,
so
my
confused.
Gosh. Yes. I remember you saying
huge.
That. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He was so swollen. But that's the hardest part as a parent. But in the same light, I also recognized him. It was kind of weird. Like, you see other pictures of babies going through this, and you're like, I could never see my child like that. Like, that is going to be crushing.
Mm-hmm.
But then when it's your child, you're like, I see him in there. He just needs to get, he just needs to kind of recover. He needs time, and he needs to heal. But my baby's still in there, you know? So it's kind of a weird, kind of surreal experience. Mm-hmm. We see him, and what happens next?
I mean, a lot of recovery, obviously, learning what kind of medication he's going to be taking, if it's, you know, long term, short term, I mean, at this point, he's not even a week old. So it's I'm thinking most recently in terms of the surgeries, right? You know, the Glenn was the most recent one that we've experienced. That was a whole thing in and of itself that we'll get to, but there was a lot of like post care from that because he was older, you know, he had done at this point, like, we're such new parents that we don't really even kind of know how to parent a child, especially like one that has been through all the medical stuff that he had already been through in less than a week old. So, I mean, at this point it was, you know, the, you know, twice daily rounds, learning like what they're doing, you know, the testing. Okay, this tube can get pulled at this time. We have to do X, Y, and Z before we can even entertain intubation. Mm-hmm. And, like, you know, these are the meds he has to come down off of. This is how we're going to transition. Just learning a lot of the anatomy change that took place and how to care for it. Now, I think we were admitted, what, 40-something days for that first
total
surgery?
It was 46.
46,
yeah.
Okay. So about a month and a half. With just, you know, this is the next step. This is the next
step.
Well,
we had a lot of actual issues shortly after, if you remember.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
So a lot of this is the next step. This is the next step. But the complications that took place, which I know you just hinted at, obviously, you know, heart surgery, they have to get going through the chest, that, you know, the scar that happens from there, the healing of that. The infection that took place.
Well, something happened before that. Do you remember?
Maybe so, I don't. Why don't you fill me in?
So Sam and I are...
like I didn't experience it.
I know, right?
Your long-term memory, I think, is better than mine.
I don't know about that. But so we go to lunch and we come back.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Killian's still sedated, but it was Sam and I's role of like, hey, this is our only. We moved here. You know, the Fisher House of Boston gave us an awesome place to stay right next to the hospital. We're going to utilize this to our max. So even if he was sedated and technically we didn't have to be there, we were there.
Yeah.
Now there are pros and cons to that because the burnout is real. But it was, you know, we just thought that we wanted Killian to know that we were there. Like, we wanted that to be his constant, even from day one.
Mm-hmm.
So we were there. He was sedated. You know, Betsy's doing her thing and taking care of him. Actually, no, it was a different nurse.
I know exactly what you're talking about. Yes, I remember this now. Yeah.
So So anyways, we go to lunch and then we come back and Killian, like, alarms started kind of going off, but they were like soft alarms and the nurse was kind of taking care of it.
Yeah. And it's one of those things too. I'll add, the alarms are a somewhat regular thing. Mm-hmm. You know, there's alarms going off here and there, but it was to the point where the alarms were going off more consistently,
yeah,
faster, more than just like one or two at a time. Like, mm-hmm, there were several going off at a time. We're sitting in the back. I can let you tick back over, but I just wanted, yeah, to emphasize that alarms were normal, mm-hmm, but they picked up in volume and quantity.
Yeah. So we're hearing this, and we're seeing one nurse come in, another nurse come in, the charge nurse come in, and they're all kind of like fiddling, but there was nothing, like there wasn't a code or anything like that. And then all of a sudden we hear like the curtain shut really quick. Mm-hmm. And they didn't ask us to leave or anything like that. They just closed the curtain. And I look at Sam and I was like, that was kind of weird. And I'm not even kidding. Within maybe 30 seconds, the curtain opens back up and it's our heart surgeon, mm-hmm, and a team of like 15 people were, yeah, in the room. And so our heart surgeon basically said, you know, he said it so calmly too, as if like, you know, it's just like a routine oil change or something like that. He's like, I don't want to, you know, scare you guys, but you know, Killian's going to need to be rushed into another emergency open heart surgery. He was 10 days old. This was 6 days after, mm-hmm, his heart surgery. And so, I go, what's going on? And he goes, well, Killian isn't breathing well right now. And he's got a little, you know, we put clamps on kids that are really small and get these heart surgeries because we need their blood flow to be a little, they can over circulate even with the new surgery. And so, mm-hmm, that clip we think just got tightened over time, like really rapidly. And so he can't breathe right now. So we need you to like leave right now and we'll have you consent as you're leaving. And so, yeah, there are people like scrubbing in and like getting ready. And I take a really, you know, quick,
I remember it was so fast. They did it in the room.
Yeah.
They didn't even have enough time to take him to an OR. Yeah.
I took a quick look at Killian as we were leaving and I just saw he was gray. He was not even gray. He was blue. Like he was clearly not breathing at all. And they were bagging him. Mm-hmm. Like he was probably really close to a code. And so we leave. And then that was like our first, okay, trip down complication lane.
Yeah.
You know, I thought back to what, you know, our cardiologist. Now I should explain the terms because you have a heart surgeon, but then you have the cardiologist and then you have the medical ICU support team.
Mm-hmm.
The cardiologist is kind of like a liaison in between the heart surgeon and the ICU team and us.
Yeah.
They kind of like translate what's going on in English to us and, mm-hmm, also provide guidance to like, you know, like what to expect next,
yeah,
answer any questions, you know, because like the heart surgeons are busy and they can't really handle piddly questions. So the cardiologist, yeah, kind of plays that pivotal role. And if you remember, when we met with Boston back when I was pregnant, his promise to us was, it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when there is a complication,
yeah,
for these risky kids. And so I kept thinking about that of like, okay, this is, you know, all part of, and I loved that. We leaned on that so much because there were so many complications. You know, that was a really helpful phrase, at least for me in those moments.
Yeah, no, absolutely. The cardiologist, I know Bryn was mentioning, but I figured I'd add some context. They're with you from the moment of diagnosis, which for us was prenatally, obviously, all the way through, you know, the rest of, you know, his life, at least pediatric wise. I mean, obviously Killian's not 18 plus yet, so I don't know, but mentioning that, obviously they are involved with every decision that takes place, medication change, surgery, anything. So obviously the heart surgeon was there to kind of, you know, guide us out of the room, but the cardiologist was not far behind us and they, mm-hmm, were able to kind of translate a little bit of like, okay, you know, obviously this is what they told you, just to give you some insight, you know, these, you know, steps are going to need to be taken in this procedure. This is what to expect. You know, mm-hmm, we'll follow up with you guys in like an hour, you know, that kind of thing. So, but yeah, first complication.
First of many.
First of many. Yes. So yeah, that took place. obviously the recovery from that. I interject, you know, fill in details whenever. I'm just kind of going off of memory at this point. But, you know, recovery from that, that was kind of like the, okay, you know, we're working towards coming, you know, what is coming home look like, you know, during that recovery and the healing of things. You know, that's when I was talking about the infection happened with his scar and the tissue around that area.
I would like to kind of interject about that experience.
The mom gut feeling.
The mom gut feeling. Yeah. I think it's important.
I knew you were going to talk on that. Yeah.
I mean, you had a little bit of a feeling too. I think mine was stronger, but, so it was about 5 to 10 days after, no, it was about 5 days after his,
the emergency that we just talked about
surgery. So he was about 15 days old. And even though it was only 15 days, he had made a lot of progress. Mm-hmm. You know, he was already, you know, starting to take some breast milk by mouth, and he was kind of, you know, he was opening his eyes. He was kind of cooing. He was, you know, being a baby. And then one day he just, there was such a shift. There was a shift in a lot of things. Like, he just started looking more pale.
I think it was before even the fever, right?
It was way before the fever.
Yeah.
He was disinterested in food. He was sleeping a little bit more. I mean, babies sleep a lot, but, like, there was no active. He was sleeping, like, almost all day.
Yeah.
You know, and I remember how I raised the concern. Now, these teams are used to handling, like, critical moments. You know, they're really equipped with that. And I remember, like, softly being kind about, like, rounds, like, Killian just seems a little bit off. Like, I don't know what's really going on. He just seems off to me. And they would say, well, what do you mean by off? And I, well, he's sleeping a little bit more, and he's not taking about as much as he's usually doing.
Yeah.
By mouth, he just looks a little bit more pale. He just seems a little off to me. And they said, well, you know, he's a hurt kid.
Yeah.
You know,
and kind of all soft signs of things to expect anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, not that our concerns were written off.
Mm-hmm.
But these were all things that they told us to look out for or just be mindful of anyway. Like, he's probably going to have feeding issues. He's probably going to have, you know, discoloration. He's probably going to sleep more because of the blood flow, you know, the circulation. Mm-hmm. So a lot of these things that more Bryn specifically was voicing, and then I was kind of noticing more and more as she was talking about it, were things that they were telling us to expect anyway. So not that it was written off, but, you know. Kind of.
Yeah, I mean,
but it's understandable in a way, you know.
Exactly.
But go ahead.
So I remember saying this for about a solid day. And, you know, and that's kind of the response I would get. You know, in a day you have anywhere from 2 to 3 rounds depending on the day. Usually morning and evening, but if, you know, these critical kids, sometimes they come around the afternoon. So I remember raising it to the different teams, and I was getting that response. And then I can't remember, it was like the next day in the afternoon, we saw on his scar, he had these like larger looking pimples on his scar. And like they started, I saw it in the morning and I was like, well, you know, he's got a fresh suture there. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, it's not fresh, but it's 5 days old.
Could be part of the healing process.
Right.
I mean, we don't know.
Could be an agitated stitch. Like, I don't know. And then they got, I remember within 5 hours, they grew to almost like, not a dime size, but it was pretty like a cap
bigger.
Size,
yeah.
You know, thing, pustule.
They were bigger than ballpoint pen size.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so we got the nurse and they were like, yeah, that does not look good. So he ended up having a really bad sternal infection. And I think the scariest part is, you know, they tested for labs and everything, but that evening, I decided to stay at the hospital, and Killian was just spiraling down. Like, you can't just throw a broad antibiotic when you have an infection like that. You have to get the cultures, you have to test the cultures, and then you have to get like a very precise antibiotic to treat it quickly and efficiently.
Mm-hmm. And what's the reason for that? Do you remember?
It's just how bacteria's.
Is it more specifically because of that age?
I think,
like, you can't just give that broad antibiotic to somebody that young.
I believe so.
Because they would develop some sort of, like...
I think it's that, Resistance.
Resistance,
you know,
thank you.
If you don't get the right antibiotic, I think they have a greater chance of developing a resistance to that antibiotic, and it's not treating the infection.
Right.
Or it takes longer.
I knew there was a reason. I just figured, you know, context for
listeners. That could be wrong, but that's my non-medical understanding.
Right, right.
And so it was that evening, and so we were in that window of, like, that happened that afternoon. They got cultures at, like, 3. I decided to stay that evening after dinner. And, you know, they had gotten the culture, or it was like around 7 p.m. and Killian's like O2 saturations were dropping really quick. Like it went from like, you know, 85 to 80 to 75 to 71 to then 68. And he looked terrible. I mean, like he looked. And so I'm, like, gently trying to wake him up. I'm trying to, you know, and at this point we have the charge nurse coming in. Like, people are quickly coming in the room. And so they were kind of, like, pulling out the bag. Like, I saw them getting really concerned about his non-responsiveness. And so they handed him to me, and they said, you know, sometimes they wake up better if they're close to their mother. So I hold him, and, like, I remember the nurse passing him to me, and he was just totally limp fish. Like, he was just, like, I got terrified. Like, that was actually more traumatic to me, like, that experience. And he wouldn't wake up for, like, 2-3 minutes.
Yeah.
So they're prepping the bag. They're getting the team. They're, like, getting the, you know, getting the oxygen prepped and everything. And they're getting the attending. And so I saw things, like, really quickly escalating. And then finally he woke up, and they bagged him, and then they got him on oxygen. They got everything back up and running. And then I think later that evening they found out that he had a staph and E. coli and staph infection, but essentially this infection would eat away at his bone. And so this kid had to have open packing in his sternum as the wound recovered. And it was a crazy experience because he had to get this done 3 times a day, morning, afternoon, and evening, because as the antibiotics are working, you want to stop the infection from spreading.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was a little bit wider than a quarter-sized opening on his sternum that, I don't know if you remember, you could actually see the sternal wires that were, you know, placed in surgery. So this kid would have to get, like, I don't know if anybody's had a kind of infection like that. It's incredibly painful. And for you to clean that is incredibly painful. And this is a baby. And so it was kind of the craziest thing. We had the infectious team come in because they have, like, a special infectious team that kind of comes in and cleans the wounds. And we found out just by, like, trial and error one day, we had Michael Bublé playing. Now, I had played music 24/7 in the womb. Like, he has always had this, like, special connection with music. And so we had Michael Bublé playing one time. And he, the infection team came in, and they were like, no, like, keep the music on. And so I'm holding his finger, and he's sucking his pacifier, and he's looking at me, and I'm kind of, like, singing, whatever. They changed his entire dressing without a peep.
Yeah.
Like, did not cry, didn't do anything. The most he would do would be this, like, wincing pain sound of, like, like, that's the most he would do, but didn't cry, didn't do anything. The next time we had to change his wound, we didn't do Bublé, and he lost his mind. And so they were like, what if you try, like, playing Bublé? Like, that seemed to really work. We put it on, immediately stopped crying. Like, and then
I think that is also a testament to the amount of music you listened to while I mean, that was a nightly thing, right?
It was about, like, 6 hours a day I would have.
That's right. It wasn't just at night. Yeah.
And my law lectures, which were far less boring.
Yeah.
Far more boring. He was starting to be known as the Bublé kid. We would have nurses come in, and they were like, is this the Bublé kid?
Yeah,
it's kind of funny. So parents, if you are, you know, if you have a, if you're pregnant with a complex CHD kid, use music because it comes in clutch.
Mm-hmm. You know? And I will say, you know, obviously Bryn having that close connection emotionally, obviously carrying Killian, you know, being his mom, The one thing that I felt that really helped me connect with, you know, Killian when he was in this stage, we also did books. Mm-hmm. And it was an opportunity for me to read books. It was one thing that I would read a book while Bryn was pregnant. I would read it. You know, and you think you're not, it's not really doing anything, right? Like, I even felt silly most nights when you were pregnant doing this. But it really, like, you really see them, like, you can tell that they remember, they recognize it. Because I can't tell you how many times I would read a book, the same book that I would read to him, you know, when you were pregnant. I would read it to him in the hospital, and he would just stare at me.
That, and then just, do you remember the vital changes?
Yes.
Every time you read to him?
Yes. So it was crazy. It was a very emotionally connecting thing for me as a dad to do.
Yeah.
You know, not having that, like, obviously motherly instinct, that, like, nurturing, like, mm-hmm. that was something that I could do, that I could visibly see him saying, like, oh, I'm comfortable. I know this. For dads out there, it sounds silly. I felt silly doing it. Mm-hmm. It really helped. It's still one of his nightly rotation books. We read a book to him every night before bed. But yeah, it's that one and a couple others. But
it was really cool. These kids really battle things like a faster heart rate, higher blood pressure, especially in between surgeries. And
yeah.
You know, it was really, really cool because once Sam would read the same book that Killian heard every night, the same night, it was the same cadence. And you make funny words, like, you know, you make a certain cadence with your voice with every word. And so they recognize that, like, vocal sound pattern.
Yeah.
Instantly, his heart rate, if it was super high, it would go probably 10 to 15 points lower. Like, it was a mm-hmm. significant drop. His blood pressure would you know, go back to normal.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really cool. So, like, whenever, I mean, the nurses hear it all the time. They're like, is there anything that they recognized in the womb that you can put on to lower their heart mm-hmm. rate? And it works.
And especially, too, because you can't always hold them in a lot of these. You can't always physically touch them, hold them. So that was something, obviously, that we could do, that mm-hmm. we knew going into this. But and we got some training going into this, obviously, mm-hmm. but something that we learned to do that would still allow us to be able to connect with him and calm him down in these situations where one of us couldn't be holding him or mm-hmm. touching him, you know, the mm-hmm. chest packing, for example. So,
So anyways,
big tip, big recommend.
Yeah. Thank you for doing that. And maybe we'll do another podcast about, like, things that, you know, moms and dads can do. Cause there was mm-hmm. definitely more that we did than that. But those are a few good ones. So,
We're 40 minutes in.
I know
we want to get through all of this.
Mm-hmm.
So not saying we speed through it.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, we're going to take our time. I think this can be a longer episode anyway. Mm-hmm. But I think at this point, like, was there any other big activities during that first admission?
No,
I didn't think so.
After
it's that transition, you know, the car seat test, mm-hmm. you know, these are the meds. This is how you order stuff. All right.
Can I talk about how they send you home, though?
Sure.
Because here, and this is why it's so critical for parents to be involved, because there will be a day where all of the expert nursing and all of these people who know how to act quickly with all this vast medical knowledge will no longer be with you. And that moment is terrifying. You know, they talk about how scary it is for you to take a healthy, like, healthy newborn home mm-hmm. your first time. A million times more scary mm-hmm. when you have a kid with CHD. It's not, but you get used to it. Like, it becomes normal, but
yeah, being sent home with 10 different medications, different things to check mm-hmm. several times a day.
Oh, and don't mess up the med schedule, because, like, these are contraindicated if, like, you give them any time in between 12 hours apart, and it's like you have to give a med at 3 a.m. So, like, don't miss that one.
Yeah.
Make sure you set an alarm. You know, so you have all these things that you have to do, and it's terrifying and it's overwhelming. But the one thing that we did is that we were involved every single day, so that by the time mm-hmm. we left, we knew how to, you know, handle the NG tube. We knew
how to.
Can't
recommend that enough. Yeah.
There are a lot of parents who, you know, they might not be able to be at the hospital as much as they can, but if you can, it will serve you wonders by the time you get home. By spending as much time, it's a brief period of time in your life. It's super stressful, but it was super helpful.
And also, at least for me, you know, I learn more by watching. I don't like to ask questions because, number one, I feel like it makes me look stupid. That's one of my biggest pet peeves.
You've gotten better with that.
I have, yeah. I have this fear for some reason that I hate to sound and look unintelligent to people.
Mm. I don't have that fear.
I highly recommend, if that is you, work on it beforehand going into it, because there is no question you can ask that is stupid. I mean, I'm thinking even just as simple as, why did you program the feed button this way? Or like, mm-hmm. you know, why are you giving this med at this time? Mm-hmm. There are things that, like, maybe they can give you, like, they'll answer it, but then there's maybe additional context that will help you understand it better, or maybe spark more important questions. Like, that was a big tip for me, at least, you know, mm-hmm. just ask any single question, because I remember we would get home. We had specific training on the feeding pump that was sent home with us, which was different than the one in the hospital. I remember sitting in that and just literally asking every single stupid question I could ask, because I didn't want to mess up something when I got home. I'm the only one that went through that training, not Bryn, because Bryn was working with something else, and I was a master with the thing by the time we got home. And I know that's something very silly. It's the food pump, you know. Mm-hmm. You can just Google it. I get that for sure. But it makes you more confident. Mm-hmm. When you have to do something in the middle of the night, you know, you have to reprogram something. And I'm using this as just a silly example, but it goes far beyond that. Mm-hmm. I found it extremely helpful to ask any question you can think of before you go home.
Yes.
Can't recommend that enough.
Yes. Super important.
Yes.
So they have something called the home monitoring program.
Yes.
That every complex CHD kid goes through.
Mm-hmm. At least for our hospital, the Boston Children's that we went to. I assume most probably have this.
So how they developed this program is kind of interesting. So they found out, you know, we have these super high success rates, you know, this is many years ago. I would say 10, it's pretty new. I'd say 10 years ago. So these kids would do, you know, really well. They send them home. I mean, really well is in a, you know, subjective term. But, mm-hmm. like, they're still in between surgeries.
Inner stage
is mm-hmm. what they call it, because they're staged surgeries. So his stage one was 3 days old, and then his Glenn operation stage two was when he was 6 months. So the time in between is called interstage. And what they found is, like, okay, these kids are surviving the first surgery. But then, like, there's a crazy high percentage of them who are actually, like, either dying in their home, they're not getting adequate care. The mortality rate between that in that interstage was crazy high. Mm-hmm. And so what they said is, we have two options. Either we keep them in the hospital the entire time, or we send them home, but we closely monitor them. And when we mm-hmm. say closely monitor, it's through something called the home monitoring program. And that is where you basically check in with a nutritionist, your cardiologist, and the nurse once or every other day. And you, on top of providing all of the meds and care, G-tube care, all of that, you have to take their temperature, their oxygen saturation, their weight, and then something else, heart rate.
Yes. Yeah.
And you have to you have to log all of that information into an app that gets sent in real time to the team. Apart from that, you are still meeting with the team and having either virtual sessions or a phone call at least every day to check.
Yeah.
And this is how critical. You may say, like, what's the difference between, like, oxygen one day and the other? Sam and I had 5 admissions in just the 6 month interstage. Well, I mean, we were in the hospital for, you know, a month and a half after he was born, but in between that and then, you know, the time we were home, we had 5 admissions.
Mm-hmm.
2 of those actually resulted in an emergency operation that was procedure
mm-hmm.
that was done, because his oxygen saturations dipped within a matter of 12 hours.
Yeah.
And then we knew that there was something wrong.
It's data tracking for noticing correlations or, you know, mm-hmm. shifts or any, like, you know, you might think, oh, his oxygen is, you know, 2 points down today than what it normally is. You know, no big deal. Next day, oh, it's 1 point. But they can see that trend. Mm-hmm. You notice the trend. Okay, for the past 2-3 days, mm-hmm. it's been going down. You know,
mm-hmm.
it's for noticing trends.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, you know, there were, anyway, so we had a really rough, I mean, it wasn't the roughest, but we had a pretty rough inner stage because mm-hmm. of, you know, and then he had vomiting issues because his heart wasn't strong enough. And then that created more feed issues. And, you know, just getting him to gain weight was a huge issue, which is the case for, for many, many, many kids.
Yeah.
And just for any parent who is stressed about like a possible admission, I wish I had put it in my mind that we will be back. You know, you like leave this place and you're like hoping that you'll never return. And then part of it is like you've set that expectation and it's going to fail,
yeah.
you know, the minute you leave. I speaking to our home monitor nurse, this is Boston Children's, which is like really, really up there. She said in my 15 years of working, she's like every year we see about 80 or so. I think that was like the number 80 or so HLHS complex CHD kiddos. I maybe have one that does not return in between surgeries. So like, it happens. It has nothing to do with the fact that you're a failure. You're not taking care of your kid. That's a huge, that was a huge thing for me as a mom. I mean, how many yeah. times was I broken down because I'm like, I put the nipple of the bottle in wrong with his mouth and now he puked up his entire feed and he lost a pound yesterday.
Yeah.
Or, like he lost 4 ounces yesterday. Like it's not, you're not a failure. You're not a less valuable mom. You just have a whole lot of stuff that you have to deal with. And it's not a failure if you return back to the hospital. It is what that child needs in that point.
Yep.
That was something I wish somebody had told me. Because how many times was I broken down in a puddle of tears?
So many.
Like, I'm a
I love
I'm a
you, but it was
mom.
It was
like,
daily. Yeah.
You know, I'm...
And not only that, but postpartum stuff. I mean,
oh,
I,
yeah.
You know.
It's, I mean, it's terrible. So anyways.
Yep.
Fast forward. We are finally meeting with our cardiology team. And they're Killian had finally gained enough weight where he was like just past the 8 pound mark, and he needed to be 10 safely, like that was the goal.
Mm.
But after the 8 pound mark, his saturations were dipping like crazy. He had 2 procedures to kind of maintain the structural integrity of his heart, and they just couldn't reinforce it anymore.
Killian was telling him he needed it.
Mm-hmm. That's what they say. We always say. The age-old question when you leave is, when do I come back for the second major open heart surgery? And they said every doctor will say your child is going to tell us when. And
yep.
It's true. You know, some kids wait until they're, you know, eighth month, 10th month to have the second. Killian lasted barely 6 months.
Yeah.
And so his heart was just not tolerating the Norwood operation anymore. And so
yeah.
We are seeing there's a phrase. Do you remember what the phrase
yeah,
is?
Yeah, get to the Glen.
Get to the Glen. And why do they say that?
Because life is supposed to get much easier after the Glen. I mean, entering out or leaving that interstage period between Norwood and Glen is obviously the hardest interstage period, at least, you know, statistically speaking. But the idea was just get to the Glen. After the Glen procedure or the Glen surgery, the new Glen anatomy, life is going to get much easier, much better. You see, feeding issues resolve themselves, you know, a majority of the time,
mm-hmm.
you know, oxygen saturations are more stable throughout the next 2 to 3 years of life. Just a lot of things are going to improve. That is, statistically speaking, the average case for a lot of these kids, most of these kids. So get to the Glen was like this idea of
mm-hmm.
just get to the Glen. Things are going to get better. It's not going to be as stressful. Just get to the Glen.
Yeah.
So we get to the Glen.
So we get to the Glen. And we're,
yeah.
you know, Sam and I were actually really excited. Because
mm-hmm.
we were like, oh my gosh, this interstage, 5 admissions, we're exhausted because a
mm-hmm.
lot of these admissions happen in the middle of the night and, you know, you have to pull an audible and can't, you know, you're just exhausted.
Call an audible.
Yeah. Okay. Not
there you
person.
Go.
But, you know, it's this long night. We had to get up at like, you know, 2 a.m. and 6 a.m. for med distributions. Like we were both exhausted.
Mm-hmm.
We were ready to have some semblance of, like, normality.
Yep.
And
so we go in on Friday.
We go in on a Friday. It was scheduled for Friday.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we're first case of the day scheduled. And so you have to
showing up 6:30, but you have to shut off the feed. How many hours? That's where you're about to go.
It's like 4 hours. And this kid is, like, you know, starving.
Yeah.
But he was such a trooper. And so 7 o'clock hits, 8 o'clock hits, 9 o'clock hits. We finally see the surgeon, and we're like, yep. Like,
he hasn't eaten for 7-8 hours at this point.
Yeah.
He's fussy.
Yeah.
What are we doing?
Yeah. So he said, we can't find a bed.
Yeah.
Now, this is a very real, there is a huge nursing crisis going on right now. And so a lot of times, if you can't find a team to support the you know, recovery of a major open heart surgery, you cancel the case.
Because if you don't have the CICU staff to be able to take care of the kid after surgery, what's the point in doing the surgery if nobody's going to be there to be able to take care of him?
Right.
Obviously, there's nurses and, you know, they're staffed, but yeah, I mean, that's a big problem. Not enough nursing to go around, really. At least at Boston Children's it was. And based off of our conversations with lots of other parents, it's, you know, similar problems elsewhere. So, Friday, definitely. We sat there. How many hours?
I mean, it was by 2 o'clock. He's like, yeah, this isn't happening.
We finally were home after lunch. Yeah. Not happening. So
this was kind of interesting because the whole interstage, you're managing meds, but you're also wanting to preserve their ability to eat. And so you have these, you know, am I feeding him enough during the day? Am I causing an oral aversion? Mm-hmm. Am I, you know, it's like this thin line that you're constantly walking. And you know what? I remember, you know, he said, I'm not going to pull a team for a Saturday because it's, you know, he's okay.
Yeah.
He can't wait like a week, but he's okay.
Yeah.
So, you know what? We'll schedule it on Monday.
Yep.
You know, we'll call you for the time slot, but we'll schedule it on Monday. And I remember we had the best 3 days because Sam and I were like, let's just put him on a continuous feed. Let's make sure his belly's full.
Well, in a way, we were frustrated, right? Because,
Initially.
We were frustrated because the idea of get to the Glen, we were there, and then we're told, no, you have to wait a couple more days.
Yeah.
Like, I was frustrated because I'm like, we did all this waiting. Like, you're telling us we have to wait, you know. Granted, looking back, it was 2 days.
Yeah.
But still, it's like, we're right there. Like, what? Like we're here. We're sitting in the pre-op area. Like, let's do this. Come on.
Mm-hmm.
And then being sent home, like it was frustrating, but you're right. We basically were like, okay, let's forget about all of the feeding stuff. You know, he's not forget about it, but let's, you know, put a pause on it. Let's not worry about it. Let's put him on a continuous. Let's just enjoy the next couple of
days. Continuous feed, meaning like you don't try to do bolus, try to make him hungry, try to make him, you know, we just
like, let's just make it easy for us. Let's, you know, he loved his bouncer, the jolly jumper. So let's.
And we did all everything that he loved.
We went on walks.
Yeah. We were quarantining. So I think we went on a walk a day. But we were also stressed about like developmentally, we have to put him in the bouncer. But like he loves his bouncer. But, you know, I don't want to put him in there for too long because we don't want, you know, you hear all of those wives' tales and, you know, of them developing abnormally. And this was just 3 days where we just threw everything out. And we were we'll give you your meds. We'll put you on a continuous feed.
Part of it, too, is we're like, this kid's going to go and be in the hospital for, you know, who knows how long. Right. So let's just let him enjoy, you know, the next couple days. And
I'm going to get teary. But, like, I really think that looking back, those few days were a gift that God really gave us.
Yeah.
It was the last few days where Killian was normal and he didn't have, I don't want to say normal, but he didn't have his brain injury and, you know, difficulty. We didn't have to worry about his ability to, is he going to walk? Is he going to do this? Like it was a total blessing in disguise.
Yeah.
And I think that God, you know, it was 100%. Kind of a God wink. In a
100% looking back on it. Yeah,
he was the happiest ever was those 2 days.
Talking about the happiest I have ever seen him, and it was 100% God's way of saying, here's a little bit of extra, like, here's the extra time, because what I'm going to put you guys through is very hard and very challenging. You guys are going to be better on the other side of it, both you and Bryn and also Killian, but it's going to be hard. Mm-hmm. And I knew he knew that going into it, and that extra weekend was 100% his way of saying, here you go. A little bit of extra time.
Yeah. So. I look back on that, like, it's kind of a bittersweet of, like, I wish I knew what time we had, but in the other way, we did.
Yeah.
Because we did.
I know there's not a thing we would have done differently.
We wouldn't have done anything different.
Yeah.
And I know I made a post about that, but it was really hard. It took me almost 9 months to even look at that video, you know, because we took a lot of video of Killian and his bouncer, of us, you know, him playing with you and laughing with you and all of that. And
it's crazy thinking back on it, even while we're talking about it, he was just getting to the point where he was almost able to sit on his own independently at that point.
Yeah.
Like, I remember I really had to just give him minimal trunk support, and you know, 6 months, I guess that I don't know if that's age appropriate or not, but it seemed like it was. I mean, you know, for spending however long in a hospital, like, that was awesome to me. Killian has worked so hard in the last 2 years that he is at that point again.
Yeah.
You know, I just realized that.
Yeah.
He's now at a point where if you sit him up, other than his, you know, hyperextension, which kind of, it does him dirty sometimes, but minimal trunk support, and he's able to sit kind of like the, because I have, there's a couple pictures from that time, yeah. that time period where I'm just really holding him at his hips and he's sitting up.
Yeah.
And that's about where he's at now. So 2 years, he's worked his way back. That's incredible.
He has. Yeah. I mean, he's, and all with a smile for sure. So
we go Monday. Monday rolls around. Same drill. First case, show up at 6 o'clock. He's off his food. No issues this time. Goes back, you know. We're talking to the team. This is what to expect. You know, we'll be checking in every hour or so. You know, make sure you have your phone on. Don't leave the hospital. We'll see you back here in a little bit type deal.
So we meet with the heart surgeon. And, again, it was the same kind of the same kind of speech he gave with the first one. Routine, you know, clockwork. With no complications. We get in the morning because especially after those surgeries, like they're pretty much sedated that evening anyway. So we went home and went to sleep. But then the next morning we came in and they were like, you know, Killian's doing great. We're thinking about making a move maybe to the step down later today. And the step down, for anybody who doesn't know hospital lingo, that's kind of like, they call it the lobby of the ICU. It's kind of like where you go.
You're on your way out.
Yeah. So it's a really good sign if you get sent to step down because they are signifying to you that
you're going to get to go home soon. Yeah. It's not one-to-one nursing at that point. It's
So
rules are a little.
There you can more eat relaxed. In the room. Yeah. It's not like everything. It doesn't have to be sterile. That kind of thing. So we were like, oh, my gosh, that's great.
Yeah.
But, like, I remember.
We were expecting, at least a week there.
We were. Yeah. Because we called, his cardiology team used to call them Killian Curveballs. And so I remember his cardiologist came in.
The Killian Curveball.
The Killian Curveball. And so our cardiologist come in. And I remember he went, so. And I just look at him and go, so. Yeah. we almost didn't want
to nobody wanted to say anything,
jinx it. We didn't want to say anything about how well he was doing, and it was like, okay, maybe this is gonna be okay, maybe he is on the road to recovery and it is this smooth, who knows. So I remember we were talking to the nursing staff that evening, and there was this one charge nurse, and she comes in at around, or it was around like 6 or 7, and you know, Sam and I were like, does one of us stay over? Like, we're not really sure. We decide to go home. And I left that night thinking for the first time, I had a huge sigh of relief because I was like, I said, I think we dodged a bullet of getting out of this surgery without a complication.
Mm-hmm.
So, I told the nurse, we'll obviously have our phones on, the ringer's on high, we'll have our phones on. Call me if he ends up getting, moved to the step down in the middle of the night. I would like to be there, to help with the transition and stuff like that. She said, yeah, absolutely, no worries. So I get a phone call at 3 a.m.
Mm-hmm.
And I had assumed that it was the nurse calling because Killian had gone to step down.
Yeah.
And so it was a guy, and I was like, oh, do you have the right number? And he goes, yeah, this is the attending. And I'll never forget how he said it. You talk about when time slows down, everything from here in the next 24 hours. It's like, I can recall the faces of the nurse. I can recall of the nurses that were in the halls, where they were, what they said. It's crazy. But he was like, I'm really sorry to call you like this, but Killian had a major cardiac arrest and he's in the process of getting put on life support, but he's not looking well. This is not looking like a good situation. We really need you to be here for medical decision making. And I was like, I was like, what? Am I dreaming? Like, I was like,
yeah.
Are you sure? And he goes, yeah, we need you to get here really quickly. And so I remember just like punching you awake and like telling you, and you even were like, what? Like,
well, I thought, I remember this because I remember you punched me, woke me up, told me this, and I thought you were joking. When I saw the look on your face when you said no, I mean, how quickly did we get changed and walk out the door? It was less than 2 minutes.
I think it was even less than a minute. I mean, like, I just threw on the nearest sweatpants and sweatshirt and we were out of there.
Yeah.
I mean, it was quick. So we get there and we meet with the team. And so they say, you know, they were like, we actually don't know what happened. He was doing fine. He woke up really irritable. He was like, I was with the nurse the entire time and she was kind of holding him, trying to calm him down. And, you know, he's like, I told her to go get some extra morphine because maybe he just needed another pain, mm-hmm. you know, pain reliever. It's not like he was due for anyone, but like she was going to get a rescue dose of a pain med. And I didn't even make it out of the door before the code went off. Like, his heart had stopped beating by the time I left the door. So it was seconds.
Yeah.
And his heart, he's like, we still don't know why. We don't know what happened. But then they said, we really tried to revive him. Like, and we weren't getting a heartbeat. And finally, after external compressions, we were able to find a pulse, but it wasn't sustained. It would be like 1-2, and then it would go away. So we tried again a second time, external compressions, 1-2, and it would go away. And then at that point, we had to make the decision to go internally and do internal compressions, which is where they open the chest and they have someone, you know, with their fingers massage and pump the heart. And again, they were able to find a heart pattern that was strong enough to put him on
to ECMO, justify life support.
Life support. And so he's like, we put him on life support. And so that's, it took us a while to get him on life support. It's a device called ECMO, where basically it's a device that externally pumps the heart for anyone in heart failure. And so, there's planned ECMO and then there's emergent ECMO. Both are terrible, but emergent ECMO is very bad. It's terrible.
Yeah.
And so he said, you know, that's as far as we know. Like, we're going to, you know, launch an investigation to figure out if we can find anything that went wrong, we'll be able to tell you. You know, but they weren't able to find anything. That's kind of the spoiler. And sometimes these things happen. I mean, these mm-hmm. kids just, their hearts kink out. It just happens.
Yep.
For whatever reason. And so the next part I remember very vividly, he said, but there's one other part that I, you know, you as parents deserve to know this part, and I want to prep you accordingly. And he's like, this is a really difficult part of my job. But he said, you know, a lot of kids with emergent ECMO placement lose a lot of oxygen, and Killian lost a lot of oxygen for a long time. He said, we were doing compressions in total for 31 to 32 minutes. That's a long time.
Yeah.
Without oxygen.
Oh, yeah.
And so he goes, I want to warn you, we are suspecting that he has pretty significant brain injury as a result. And so I asked him, I said, well, is it, you know, we kind of go through our questions. And the very last question was the one that was, like, really going to break my heart if I knew the answer, and I kind of knew what he was going to say. But I said, have you seen kids go on and off ECMO in these situations without brain injury? And he goes, yes. And I go, do you anticipate that being the case for Killian? And he goes, I'm sorry, but no. And so with that answer, I just remember I was like, okay, I have all the information I need for right now.
Yeah.
And then I permitted myself to just absolutely crumble.
That was the point where you broke down.
And it was terrible. I mean, like, think about from a mother's perspective, this was a kid who was bouncing his bouncer like 48 hours ago.
Right.
You know, and smiling and laughing and giggling and cooing and, you know, doing all the normal baby stuff, and now I have to worry about, like, what is this new Killian?
One of the few moments in life where I genuinely had no idea what to do. Like, not a clue. I didn't know what to think. I didn't know what to say. I didn't know what to recommend. I was literally blank inside.
So we get up to the room. We can go see him now. And it was dramatically far worse than I had ever thought it would be. I mean, there was more tubes, coverings, things coming out of him than I could actually see.
There was more medical equipment than baby than in the baby. Bassinet.
It was crazy. It was wild. They had the EEG. They had the frontal lobe scanner. They had a gajillion. I mean, there were probably 30 plus, not 30, but like maybe 20-ish things coming out of him.
Yeah. And, probably some listeners, also CHD parents that, you know, may or may not be, you know, have been able to experience something like that. Not that that is any blessing to experience, but you don't really fully understand that feeling until you, like, I feel like even just us talking about it, it doesn't do it justice in terms of the emotions and the feelings that I felt. Like I just mentioned, I don't worry about it until it's in front of me. Well, it was in front of me right there.
Yeah. I also want to bring up something that if you are a prenatal CHD parent, somehow finding our podcast, which would be crazy.
Shot in the dark, but hey.
Shot in the dark.
Hit us up.
We are being very real and honest. This is a very dark and painful journey as of right now that we are taking you through. There is light on the other side.
Yes.
We are going to talk about that.
That is the important takeaway from this. Yes. This is the groundwork, or we're laying the groundwork for why we're doing what we're doing.
And the beauty on the other side of the pain. But we can't show that without showing you the pain.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
and sharing experiences and why you should listen to us and even care about what we have to say.
True.
You know, not that we have all of the answers, but for this specific type of situation, we lived it, and we lived it for the better part of a year.
Yeah. So don't sit there. You know, I'm not going to say that it won't happen. More likely than not, it won't, you know, like having a cardiac arrest in the way that Killian did was very rare, very, very rare, especially after a Glenn. I mean, this was statistically the more successful surgery.
Supposedly the in and out, they told us about a week.
Yeah. So, you know, it's rare. It happens, but it's rare.
Yeah.
So I just, you know, don't get caught up in the pain that we are talking about, because it is all part of the story that we are going to get to. But we, like Sam said, we had to lay the groundwork. So we get to his room. We see this baby that, you know, we still see as Killian, but is widely unrecognizable. We let time pass. We meet with the team. And our cardiology team, who is amazing, they basically said, you have 72 hours. And I said, what does that mean? And they said, if there is brain injury. And I said, well, what do you mean, what if? And they said, well, it's going to show in a couple of ways. It's going to show in seizure activities. And it's going to show through things like, you know, there's something called Clonus. So there's a lot that we can really, a lot of detail that we can put into Killian's recovery. But, you know, to spare time, I'll let readers know. I go into detail with that in the book that I wrote. We'll put the link in there.
Yeah, yeah. We'll include that in the show notes, Amazon link, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. And but the long, you know, the short story of Killian's recovery is that it was not looking good from day one.
Yeah.
You know, so they gave this window of time, you know, 72 hours of when brain injury was going to show itself. And as they were doing that 72-hour window, they were lifting sedation meds slowly and slowly.
Yeah.
And so that's why they said, you know, if there is injury, it's, you know, it's going to show within that time. And Killian had intense, really harmful activities, or harmful seizures, seizure activity.
Yeah, I know what you meant.
And basically at the 60th hour, he was starting to fully contract and have these grand mal type seizures. Mm-hmm. So they continued to monitor with the EEG, and they basically found that there were four areas in his brain that were going under severe attack.
Yeah.
And the neuros, they called them like neurostorms, that were seizure activities that were, you know, triggering each other.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this was a really scary period of time because this was, and I don't know if you remember this, but we're speaking to the neurologists and it went from, you know, Killian likely has brain injury, but we don't know how severe, to, oh my gosh, he's having the seizure activity, to, holy moly, we can't control his seizures for four plus hours.
Yeah. I mean
they threw the kitchen sink at him.
They told us to expect the worst.
Yeah.
I mean,
and it wasn't until a neurologist came in and said, he said two things that really just put Sam and I into a different category of concern for Killian. Mm. The first thing he said is seizures of this caliber that are triggered by brain injury and lasting this long and this severe, if they last longer than 30 seconds without a break, then it has high potential to further damage the brain, meaning the seizure itself can further injure the brain injury that is currently present.
Compounding injury.
Yeah, if you want to think of it that way. And so the next question we asked was, well, how significant was this, you know, what did you find on his seizure activity? And they said, well, it's really not good.
Yeah.
And they said, we only captured what was likely seizure activity that was occurring before we put on the EEGs, because you can't just leave EEGs on or else they'll burn the scalp.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to take them on and off and give the scalp a break in time to heal before you put them back on.
You have to time it with the medication sedation weans. That way, they're able to actually capture things.
Right. And so once there were visible signs of seizure activity, they put the EEGs back on, but he was in a skin break is what they call it.
Yeah.
And so what they said is once we were able to capture that information, what we found in that 4-hour window that they couldn't control these seizures is that the longest break of time between seizures was 10 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
That was the longest break.
Yeah.
And so he's like, but it's even worse than that. Like, he's like, I'm really sorry, but like, he's probably been having this kind of subliminal seizure activity that we weren't able to capture because he was sedated for 12 plus hours.
Yeah.
And so it went from he likely has significant brain injury to he definitely has brain injury to holy moly, this is not looking good. This is pretty severe brain injury that we're seeing.
Yeah.
And
of course, any question you ask as a parent, it's they call a crystal ball question. You know, right. Nobody has the answer to it. Nobody really wants to give any sort of educated guess even. It's just, well, we'll see.
Yeah.
And that was honestly the most frustrating part, at least for me.
Yeah. Because it's like we want to know what we can do and how to adjust our expectations.
Cardio is very black and white. It was either this or that. There wasn't a whole lot of gray area. Not the case for neurology at all.
It was incredibly scary. And so the next question we asked was, what does this mean for Killian, right? A little bit of a question, a crystal ball question. But all the neurologist could really say was, I am concerned for Killian.
Mm-hmm.
And when a neurologist is saying that, you know, it's pretty bad. It was almost like this event happened and everybody just kind of like didn't want to say anything.
They
didn't want to give us a picture of what might happen or could be our reality, because frankly they couldn't. But I do remember from my time in pediatric neurology, this is kind of like a full circle moment, you know, we talked a lot about neuroplasticity.
Yes.
And neuroplasticity, for those of you who don't know, is the brain's ability to relearn or learn in a new way how to perform a certain task.
Mm-hmm.
And so there were three things when we researched, you know, how to optimize neuroplasticity. We saw that number one, the younger an injury happens, the better the outcome. And that's because if a brain doesn't know how to brush your teeth, then you can essentially teach that skill with the limitations that you have and still perform the function.
The brain's going to basically map the functionality in a way that may not be normal to the normal, or maybe not be the same as like a quote unquote normal person, but it will nonetheless be mapped because it's being mapped in its own way.
Exactly.
So
this is why people without, you know, limbs or, you know, differences are able to do their hair and still feed themselves and drive a car. It's because the brain is learning how to do that really quickly.
Right.
And so the second thing we knew is that the there after the injury, there's a 1 year window where the most neuroplasticity will be optimized.
Mm-hmm.
And then the third thing, again, on this very limited research that we found, is that the most effective way is not hyperbaric chamber, it's not nutrition, it's not, you know, whatever thing, red light therapy or whatever. The most effective way to optimize is through therapy. Tons and tons of old-fashioned OT, PT, speech and language therapy.
Yep.
So anyways, that's what we found out together. And
Important filler. Yeah, thank you. I was moving a little quick there. So yeah, so we decide, okay, this is what we know. This is what he needs. How are we going to make it happen? Well, the obvious answer is somebody stays home and does this with him every day, day in and day out, while the other person works. Now, obviously, with Bryn having SMA, you having SMA, I'm saying this like I'm not, yeah. We knew as Killian was going to grow, get bigger, it was going to be more difficult and challenging for Bryn to be able to provide the most effective therapy that would be able to capitalize on this neuroplasticity. So, us talking it over, and also it probably definitely helped that, like, you know, Bryn kind of has her law degree and her MBA, like, and, you know, full disclosure, was making more money than me. So it made more sense for Bryn to continue working and me step down. So anyway, we go through the pediatric rehab or the pediatric rehabilitation hospital program. We get discharged. It is at this point we thought we were going to be settling down in New Hampshire. Turns out Bryn had a connection with this is probably where you could pick in and fill in a little bit better, but
this is kind of a crazy story. So we get this like excellent rehab experience inpatient. And then it's all up to us. And we were piecemealing it, but we didn't have like an expert on Killian's situation. He's not like a normal kid who can go to therapy.
Mm-hmm.
He's got half a heart. He's got limitations. You know, there is just not a lot of people who are specialized in what he needs. So I had an old colleague. She was a resident. Like
back when you were at your position at Hopkins.
Like we're talking six, seven years ago. So she reaches out to me and she's like, oh my gosh, how are you? Second of all, so sorry to hear about Killian. Third of all, you need to come see me. And I was like, yeah, like we'll go get coffee. We'll hang up, you know, like we'll hang out and catch up and it'll be great. She's like, no. I mean, like, you need to come see me. And I was like, oh, why? And she goes, I work at a hospital now called Kennedy Krieger Institution, short for KKI. And so I was like, oh, yeah, we refer kids to KKI all the time. And she goes, yes, but I'm a neurodevelopmental specialist, and I work with specifically a cardiac team. And all they do is help rehab the brain from infants who have had brain injury as a result of CHD. And I was like, you've got to be kidding me.
Like, talk about a just mind-blown moment.
Yeah. I was like, wait, so you – and she's like, yeah, we have, like, a team of five people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they all work with these CHD kids. And the brain injury looks different than a normal kid because it's, you know, it's just a different pattern. A lot of them are ECMO injuries or – you know, similar to what Killian has. And so we get an appointment with her. And then that was like that, this team, like I can't shout enough praises with this team at KKI.
Yeah.
They are so amazing.
I'm still working. Bryn's working. We knew we had to capitalize on this.
So that's where we are right now. We're still in Maryland. Killian is still mm-hmm. getting followed by this team.
Yeah. And
he gets 6-month checkups with the neurodevelopmental mm-hmm. team, and then they kind of adjust course. But mm-hmm. I mean, to see this kid was at the beginning of his neuroplasticity and neuro rehab, staring at a wall.
Yeah.
I mean, zero to very little to no interaction.
Therapy's still going strong. We just finished up a rehabilitation an intensive rehabilitation program where it kind of simulated in a way that rehab hospital experience, but like on a little bit of a smaller scale, kind of like a part-time job is what I jokingly called it. It was like, it was Killian's part-time job. We went into,
that's kind of funny.
We went into, people were calling it school. I was like, no, this is part-time job. He's in there working. What are you talking about? but we would go in, we would go in at 8 a.m. and we'd be there until lunch, and he would get three sessions, 3 hours, PT, OT, and SLP, speech, where they would work sit to stands, rolling over, sitting, you know, independent sitting, because he, you know, he's still working on that. He still can't do a lot of those, all of those things. Integrating left hands, you know, eating, talking, you know, and he has just taken off from a, more specifically, a communication and cognitive perspective. I mean, I see this kid understanding full sentences when we talk to him now, and he was already on that path, but I mean, you say a sentence to him and it's like, he understands what you're saying. He just can't, you know, use that expressive language to communicate back to you. I mean, he does in his own way, and he's learning how to, and he's been able to say so many more words and, you know, interact in so many more ways. But I mean, he's taken off. And you know, if you're listening to this for the first time and you have no idea about any of the past year therapy journey that he's been on, you know, I really encourage you to check out the page just from the simple, just from the perspective of, you can see, Bryn does a great job of creating like side-by-side videos of like, you know, over the past 6 months, this is where, this is the progress, and this is what he's now doing, and this is what he looks like. Tons of content there to just really see the difference in the change that I'm talking about. Because I feel like even just talking about it, it's not doing it justice.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And even the transition when we first came back to Maryland, and, you know, we had the meeting and the appointment with Kennedy Krieger, his doctor there, her doing her initial assessments, you know, it in a way kind of mirrored what those neurologists at Boston Children's were saying. I mean, I think she scored him like 3 to 5 months cognitively. 2 to 3 months from a, you know, PT, OT, you know, fine and gross motor skill perspective. Like,
and at that point, he was what, 7 months?
He was seven or eight months. Okay. Yeah, something like that. So, I mean, directly mirroring what the neurologists were already telling us, I mean, we're having another doctor from a third party, you know, that we're now establishing care at, confirming this. Terrifying, you know, and this is still in the moment where, you know, Killian's, he's getting better, but he still has his moments where he's just kind of staring blankly. He doesn't really interact. He doesn't, you know, he doesn't do the things that, you know, a normal, obviously a normal 7 to 8 month old would do, but not even where they're putting him, it seems, at like the 2 to 3 month mark. So taking that, obviously, and then pairing it with the neuroplasticity and emphasizing that window that we knew he was in, obviously me stepping down, my entire role became that, you know, full-time PT, OT, speech, whatever I can do to facilitate that care. So that involved taking notes at appointments, making sure that whatever I was doing at home directly mirrored what the therapists were doing. And that obviously involved some hands-on work for me in the appointments, that involved the therapist coming to our home to kind of assess, okay, what's our setup like? Like, how can, you know, I capitalize on, you know, the therapy that I do at home? So that over time, obviously, him going through that intensive program that we just went through, it's incredible. I mean, cognitively now, they're scoring him 18 to 24 months, which is insane. It's putting him now closer to where he would actually be. I mean, he's 22 months. And when I say 18 to 24, they judge that based off of a set of skills. And they said he's doing about half of them, maybe a little over half. But a majority, if not all, of the 15 to 18 month goals. I mean, so you even put it in perspective that that injury, when it happened at 6 months, it essentially erased everything, you know, and that was even before a lot of things were really truly formed. Like, I know I mentioned him sitting up on his own. He wasn't quite doing yet, but he was getting there. I mean, that's kind of age appropriate for 6 months. He had to learn how to do that all over again. But now he's a bigger baby with bigger muscles that aren't fully formed and developed. So it's just 10 times as hard at that point.
Here's the takeaway that I want people, because I know we said that, you know, we're going to talk about our pain and we're going to talk about the anguish of the event, because I think that deserves a place to recognize that. Because the smile that Killian has is a different smile than a kid who hasn't gone through. He's had to fight for that smile.
Yeah.
Every day. And he's had to fight for everything that he can do. And you can see the joy and satisfaction that comes over his face when he knows he can do something is unmatched. I mean,
people, I did it is his favorite, one of his favorite phrases now.
It's hilarious. Like his therapists think it's hilarious because like they'll be working on something for a while and then finally it clicks. And then he looks at him, I did it. And they're like, yes, you did. You did it.
It sounds I-yay-it.
Yeah.
But you know what he's saying.
And it's
yeah.
And it's beautiful. So, I mean, you have this life. It's messy. And sometimes things are, you have these Killian curveballs. And sometimes they can be near-death experiences. But, you know, by never quitting and never stopping, always believing and doing the thing that people are not brave enough to do, which is to find the hope, to cling to it, even if it's by a thread, even if it's like your hope rope is like down to its final thread, not letting go and just, you know, doing the things, the hard things that people don't want to do, like sacrificing a salary to give him therapy, to give him what he needs. It's so worth it in the end. And like I said, that path, there's way more beauty to it. So Killian's story is why we really crafted this podcast. And so we've heard Sam's story. We've heard my story. We've now finally heard Killian's story.
Yeah.
Everything. This was a longer one, I'll admit. So enjoy it. But a lot of what we discuss here is helping parents navigate similar experiences.
Yep.
What it's like to have a disabled child, what it's like to be a parent with a disability, how we make marriage work, how we... you know, how you find the joy and satisfaction in marriage with, you know, a lot of difficulty.
How a caregiver, stay-at-home dad can still feel like a dad.
Yes. And a father and a leader. And, you know.
I'll let you know if I figure it out. No, I'm just kidding. I'm kidding.
That's part of it. You're still learning.
Yeah.
We're all learning.
Yeah. And by no means am I saying, you know, anything of what we went through is us being an expert, but
no. But we've seen a thing or two. And so that's what this podcast is really going to be, is, you know, all of those things and more, and then also kind of helping things like how to, you know, discipline's a harsh word, but like behavioral shaping techniques for kids who have real limitations. It's really difficult. That's a hard one. To kind of coach, and no one prepares you for that. I mean, unless you're a therapist, you're not, you know, no one tells you these things. So we're going to be the people who share what we know and what we've been through. And
what's worked for us, what we found didn't work for us, you know. Yeah.
And so we hope that you've enjoyed listening to Killian's story. Mm-hmm. If there's a particular topic that you want us to discuss, tips of how we'd survive the ICU is, you know, young married couple, how we started Killian's rehab journey from day one. It was a lot of thought even at day one.
Still takes a lot of planning.
Still takes a tremendous, our calendars,
plural,
are very vast and full. So
lots of to-dos, to-do lists.
Yeah, we like that. Except for when it becomes a distraction. But anyways, comment. Follow us on our Instagram pages, and we hope that you've enjoyed listening to Killian's story, and be sure to subscribe for more content.
Yeah, no, it was great. Loved having the conversation. Thanks, everybody, for listening.